is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, November 22, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. As calls for justice after Fallujah grow louder inside Iraq, the Iraqi Prime Minister says the media misreported what happened and that people will soon be able to return home. We bring you reaction from Baghdad. An omnibus spending bill snuck into lawmakers' hands Saturday night with significant cuts to education and low-income housing and mandating doctors to deny abortion services passes Congress 24 hours later. And is there an end in sight for locked-out hotel workers in California? But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. More than 10,000 Ukrainians went to Independence Square in Kyiv today to demonstrate against the pending election results. According to officially released numbers, the current Prime Minister, Viktor Yanukovych, backed by Russian leaders, is in the lead for the presidency. However, supporters of Viktor Yushchenko say the elections were rigged and refuse to leave the square until their candidate is declared the winner. International election observers, including contingents from the European Parliament, NATO, and a U.S. delegation led by Senator Richard Lugar, agree that the incumbent government helped rig the vote in favor of the prime minister. Israeli officials say they will remove travel restrictions and other obstacles to Palestinian elections in the occupied territories. Officials in Ramallah and elsewhere in Palestine are preparing for the upcoming vote. Awad Davis has more.
Palestinians are wondering whether it is the end of the U.S. administration boycott to them, or is it the end of the term of Mr. Colin Powell in his post that drove him to the region. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's main issue of discussion with the Palestinian leadership was the presidential elections that are due on the 9th of next January. Three independent Palestinians announced their official candidacy to the Palestinian elections. So far, Fatah major faction in Palestine did not nominate its candidate, who will be probably the former Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen. The Islamic movements of Hamas and Islamic Jihad will boycott the elections, and the left wing is expected to nominate the civil society activist Mustafa Barghouti. The door will stay open for another 10 days for the Palestinian presidential election. And with the absence of an international presence, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict might stay open for years, even decades. I'm Awad Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
More than 20,000 people, many of them Muslim, took to the streets in Germany to protest against violence directed against Muslim communities and terrorism. Guy Deegan reports from Cologne.
For Germany's 3.5 million Muslims, Sunday's protest follows anti-Muslim anxiety stirred up in Western Europe after the murder of Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh by a suspected Islamic extremist earlier this month. President of the Turkish Islamic Union and protest organizer Ridvan Çakır told the Cologne demonstration, terrorism has neither a religion nor a nationality of its own. Conservative right-wing politicians in Germany now argue that imams should only be allowed to preach in German and not Turkish or Arabic to avoid suspicion of inciting hatred. In Cologne, Germany, I'm Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
16,000 protesters marched in front of what is commonly called the School of the Assassins at a U.S. military base in Georgia. WZRD's Johnny Happ was there.
During the two-day protest outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, activists said they traveled from around the country to stand for those who were murdered by oppressive regimes throughout Latin America and to demand the closing of this training facility, now known as the Western Hemispheric Institute for Security Cooperation. Father Roy Bourgeois is the founder of the SOA Watch, the movement named after the former name of the school.
So we are here once again to use our voices, as Bishop Romero said before he was killed by graduates of the school. He said, let those who have a voice speak out for the voiceless. And so we gathered and we're calling for the closing of this school. It should not be in existence.
Alonso Vasquez Gomez.
For 2.5 hours on Sunday, the names of victims from Latin America who were tortured, murdered, and disappeared were read aloud as thousands chanted in unison Presente and placed white crosses within the fence of Fort Benning. SOA Watch vows to return every year in greater numbers until the school is shut down by the U.S. government. From Fort Benning, Georgia, this is Johnny Happ for Free Speech Radio News.
California's Attorney General stands ready to sue the Bush administration if the U.S. Forest Service does not change its plan to allow more logging in the Sierra Nevada. More from Kelly Ramirez from KPFA.
The U.S. Forest Service is amending a 2001 logging plan to allow harvesting of four times more wood in the Sierra Nevada than under the original plan. California Attorney General Bill Lockyer said in a statement Friday that with this action, the Bush administration maintains its full-speed retreat from environmental protection. If the plan is finalized as is in 2 weeks, Lockyer says he'll go to federal court. According to the Bush administration's Forest Service, the additional logging will help to curb wildfires. But on September 8, 2000, the Forest Service and the Department of the Interior stated, quote, "The removal of large merchantable trees from forests does not reduce fire risk and may, in fact, increase such risk," unquote. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
An influential member of the Sunni clerics group, the Association of Muslim Scholars, or AMS, was assassinated just a day after Iraqi officials announced elections would take place on January 30. The AMS had called for a boycott of national elections. Sheikh Faith Mohammed Amin Al-Faidi was reportedly leaving a place of worship when he was killed in the northern town of Mosul. The AMS says it's the target of US and Iraqi forces and has armed Sunni fighters to strike back. Meanwhile, US-installed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi says the media in Iraq is failing to report the real situation in Fallujah. FSRN correspondents Salam Talib and Dar Jamil report from Baghdad. Dar Jamil, Iyad Alawi has said that the Iraqi media is misreporting Fallujah. Is that a fair statement?
This is a fair statement. U.S.-appointed Prime Minister Iyad Alawi says that the media is misreporting Fallujah, and while that is accurate in reference to U.S. media, who are reporting that the fighting is over and no civilians have been killed, the fact is that independent media, along with all of the Arab media, are reporting the truth as coming from a couple of journalists who have managed to report from inside of the city, as well as being verified by countless refugees now who are all around Baghdad and other cities outside of Fallujah, who are reporting the same atrocities which have occurred there at the hands of the U.S. military. Atrocities such as tanks rolling over wounded people in the streets, people being shot while they tried to swim across the Euphrates River to escape from the siege, people being trapped in their homes with no food or water or medical care for days on end. These are the facts. This is information coming straight from the people in Fallujah who suffered through the siege. And these are the facts that Mr. Alawi does not want to get out.
How's the recovery effort going in Fallujah? Are refugees returning to their homes yet?
Refugees are not being allowed to return to their homes yet. The U.S. military is maintaining a strict cordon around the city, and they still are not allowing any medical teams to go inside the city. They've allowed some medical supplies to finally reach the general hospital there, and they have brought some wounded people themselves out of the city. But they are keeping it under very tight control. They're not letting any media in there. They're not letting any relief teams to report on the situation on the ground. So there are at least 200,000 Fallujah refugees now scattered about, while upwards of 100,000 people do still remain trapped inside of the city.
Has there been any counts on the death toll of civilians from the Fallujah assault?
There has not been an accurate full count and probably won't be for a long time. The only thing close to an estimate we've received so far was a Red Cross official in Baghdad who estimated that at least 800 civilians have been killed. However, most relief workers and people inside Fallujah fear that that number will be far, far higher. In fact, there have already been mass graves begun outside on the outskirts of Fallujah. There are people being buried that no one knows. No, there's no one there to identify them or even claim the body. So it's going to take a long time to tabulate these numbers, especially the fact, on top of the fact that no families have been allowed to return to the city. But these numbers will eventually come out.
It seems like the attacks are continuing from the Iraqi resistance. Would you say that the U.S. attack on Fallujah stamped out a good part of the fighters?
The attacks are continuing throughout Iraq, including Baghdad, and especially in Fallujah. all of the residents coming out are telling the same story, and that is that while there are a very large presence of U.S. military in the city, they are being attacked constantly. Many people are even telling stories that now many resistance fighters are surrounding Fallujah and launching attacks on the military from the outskirts. So that, on top of the fact that as we see fierce resistance breaking out in numerous other cities such as Ramadi, Samarra, Latakia, Mosul, Bakuba, Beji, Qa'im, all over Iraq, including Baghdad, there are fierce attacks, with the military sustaining upwards of 100 attacks per day now, and this number wasn't nearly as high before the siege of Fallujah. So these claims of the military, quote-unquote, breaking the back of the insurgents in Fallujah apparently are not only untrue, but has in fact increased and spread the resistance around much of Iraq now.
Dar Jamil, FSRN correspondent in Baghdad. On Saturday, negotiations on the 9/11 intelligence reform bill fell apart due to objections of the House Armed Services Committee and the Pentagon, even after President Bush asked for its approval. Also on Saturday, Congress passed an omnibus spending bill that makes significant cuts to education, environment protections, and low-income housing assistance. Another provision snuck in the 3,000-page bill that lawmakers had less than 24 hours to review allows healthcare providers to mandate its doctors and hospitals to deny abortion services. Mitch Jeserich reports from Capitol Hill.
Healthcare providers, including insurance companies, will soon be allowed to prohibit its hospitals and doctors from performing abortions and educating women on such reproductive options, including making referrals. It's part of a budget bill passed on Saturday that also prohibits states that use Medicaid dollars to pay for abortion services for low-income women from requiring its doctors to perform such procedures. Republican Representative Dave Weldon is the sponsor of the measure.
This provision is meant to protect healthcare entities from discrimination because they choose not to provide abortion services.
Let's be clear. This provision is nothing more than a payoff to the religious right.
The measure angered many Democrats who were unable to stop its inclusion in the budget bill. Representative Lynn Woolsey of California.
No matter how you look at it, this provision goes one step further by making it impossible for women to exercise their reproductive choices and once again subjects them to the wrath of the anti-choice movement.
The abortion provision is part of an omnibus spending package that funds 9 governmental departments. It is the first post-election budget bill to be passed, and it contains significant cuts in non-military spending. Such reductions are found in education, especially in special education and in college financial aid. Several $100 million were cut for the Environmental Protection Agency, and cuts were made to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Though small increases were made to the Low Income Assistance Heating Program, it falls far short of the 24% rise in energy bills expected this winter. Democratic Representative Jim McGovern questions Congress's priorities.
Mr. Speaker, the sun is shining on American corporations that choose to take advantage of a special tax loophole by incorporating in the Caribbean islands. But here at home, in particular my home state of Massachusetts, it is going to be a cold, dark winter for many seniors and low-income families.
While House Democrats criticize the budget, Republican House Leader Tom DeLay of Texas says the people have spoken.
So, ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake about it. There are two philosophies. They presented their philosophy in the election. We presented our philosophy in the election. And with all due respect, the American people chose.
The 3,000-page omnibus bill was introduced just after midnight on Saturday morning, and it was passed less than 24 hours later. Most lawmakers admit they had not read the bill before the vote. After the House already passed the bill, Senate Democratic staffers found language that would give congressional staff members access to any citizens' or businesses' tax returns. Democrats attacked the Republican leadership of trying to invade people's privacy. That led to this outburst by Republican Senator Ted Stevens, who claimed they didn't know that such a provision was in the bill.
I don't know how to put any further. I'm tired of it. We've been working hard on this bill. We did not do this.
To imply that we did, either Congress Young or I did it, is wrong. Wrong!
The provision was taken out, but Democratic Senator Tom Harkin has deep reservations on how it even got in there.
It was not accidentally put in. These things do not happen by accident. Someone purposely put it in, and it was not a staff person.
House representatives had just 12 hours to review the 3,000-page bill before voting on it, and the Senate had about 20 hours. Many people are concerned about what else could be in the bill that wasn't found beforehand. Republican Senator John McCain gave this sarcastic statement from the Senate floor.
Why are we going to talk so little about it? I'd like to talk for hours about it, but I don't have the courage to hold up the travel plans of all of my colleagues.
The Republican congressional leadership stripped out other provisions in the spending bill that were previously approved by Congress. They took out a provision to ease the Cuba travel ban, a provision to undo the Labor Department's overtime rule change, and a provision to keep the Bush administration from privatizing federal jobs. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
The official results of the 2004 presidential race are hanging in the balance while vote counting in Ohio continues amid widespread controversy over whether the election was fair. Questions still remain as to whether the votes of many Ohioans were accurately recorded. Several lawsuits are being filed, including one by a coalition of public interest lawyers, which will go before the state Supreme Court, challenging Ohio's reported vote tally. The Democrats, including presidential candidate John Kerry, have come under attack for not leading the charge to discover what really happened in the Ohio elections. FSRN's Mitch Jezrich spoke to John Kerry this weekend on Capitol Hill.
I think that every vote ought to be counted.
Do you support the Green Party and Libertarian Party moving forward in that effort?
I support every vote being counted. I support the process working the way it's supposed to.
How about being more involved in getting a recount there?
We're making sure there is one. We've been very involved. Our lawyers are on the ground right now.
Meanwhile, numerous investigations into possible fraud and voter disenfranchisement are also currently underway, as Evan Davis reports from Columbus.
While the votes in Ohio are still being counted, the final tally, which is expected by December 6th, may not be the last word on who actually won the presidential race of 2004. Last week, the Green and Libertarian Party presidential campaigns officially filed for a recount in all of Ohio's 88 counties. Then, on Friday, a coalition of nonpartisan organizations led by the Ohio chapter of Common Cause announced their intention to contest the vote once it is certified. Cliff Arnebeck is an attorney with Common Cause.
The purpose of the contest of the election is to verify the accuracy of the vote and the integrity and honesty of the election process in Ohio in this past presidential election.
The contesting of the election may move the Ohio Supreme Court to rule on the outcome, or it may set the outcome aside and demand a new election altogether. A lot depends on the plaintiff's ability to document widespread patterns of irregularity in the voting process that call the recorded vote tallies to question. Arnebeck's team intends to investigate all aspects of the voting process and to bring in forensic computer analysts to examine the electronic voting machines in the 7 Ohio counties that use them. Bob Petrakis is one of the attorneys that will be litigating the contest of the election.
Remember this. Remember, we all laughed when, after Florida, it was reported in the mainstream press that certain counties in Ohio, poor counties, had purchased the machines that had malfunctioned in the 2000 Florida election. So we need to really get in there, look at those machines.
Public hearings are being held in every major city in Ohio to hear from voters who found their access to the polls hindered on Election Day or who have substantial concerns about the accuracy of the vote and whether or not their own votes will be counted. Already, hundreds of testimonies have been given under oath, chronicling difficulties with the electronic voting machines, intimidation from Republican challengers, and prohibitively long lines at the polls. Prior to Election Day, the Democratic Party successfully fought to overturn rule changes that would have limited voter eligibility and which would have hampered voter registration, such as the requirement that voter registration forms be printed on 80-pound bond paper. But all of the public hearings in Ohio since Election Day have been organized by nonpartisan groups, and this has some wondering what the hundreds of lawyers the Kerry campaign has placed in Ohio have been doing lately. Tom Rosenberg is the Kerry campaign's lead counsel in Ohio.
John Kerry has stated he does not want this election outcome to be litigated in the way that the year 2000 election was litigated. It's ultimately his decision as to what he wants to do. That's what he's saying right now, but he's asked us to personally guarantee to him that every vote is counted.
But Blair Bobier, media director for the Green Party candidate David Cobb's campaign, doesn't think the Kerry campaign's efforts have been sufficient or thorough.
A recount is an essential step in counting every vote in Ohio. We know, for starters, that 93,000 spoiled ballots won't be counted or examined unless there's a recount. And it's ironic that the Democratic Party leadership isn't standing up for the Democratic voters, and they're leaving it to the Green Party to do that.
Under Ohio law, all candidates must be given 5 days' advance notice before a recount can commence, and no recounting can begin until after the election has been certified by the Secretary of State. Ohio's Secretary of State, Republican Ken Blackwell, who was also a Bush campaign co-chair, has extended the certification deadline to December 6th, just 7 days before the national deadline for delegates to the Electoral College to submit their votes, which ultimately decide the presidency. That could leave as little as 2 days for the recount to be conducted, and according to Beaubier, that's not enough time.
The time allotted by the Ohio Secretary of State's office is simply not enough time to conduct a meaningful recount. Our attorneys will be in federal court in Ohio today filing a lawsuit seeking to expedite the process so that we have time for a meaningful recount and all votes are counted.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
An end to the long-running labor dispute that's locked out hotel workers in California looks likely. About 4,300 Unite Here Local 2 members who've been locked out since October 1 will be returning to work while contract talks continue. On Saturday, as hundreds gathered in San Francisco's Union Square for a rally in solidarity with the locked-out workers, Mayor Gavin Newsom announced at his office across town that a deal had been reached to suspend the stalemate for a 60-day cooling-off period. FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo has more.
Unite Here Local 2 members who'd been working without a union contract since August 14th struck at four San Francisco hotels September 29th and were subsequently locked out at 10 others by the Multi-Employer Group, a consortium of San Francisco's 14 largest hotels. Rory O'Connor, a bellman at the Four Seasons, says the workers wanted a wage increase but voted for a 2-week strike when the hotels tried to eliminate retiree medical, prescription, and dental coverage from about 1,000 Local 2 members.
People here, it's not like they're making a lot of money to begin with. I mean, it's almost like all along, I mean, even the union has said this, that like we've accepted lower wage increases in return for good benefits. It's almost like it's part of the compensation package.
Another sticking point is the contract's length. Union members say they'd like to renegotiate in 2 years while the hotels want a 5-year deal. Toh Doe, Secretary Treasurer of Unite Here Local 2, says the union also wants to synchronize San Francisco hotel contracts with other cities.
We bring our fight to across North America city. We bring our fight to Hawaii, to Monterey, to Chicago, to New York, to send them the message that we're not going to be isolated in San Francisco.
The rank-and-file workers at Saturday's rally were elated at the news they'd soon be back on the job and are hopeful that the publicity generated will parlay into the contract they want. Nasita Mangana is a room attendant also employed at the Four Seasons.
We are happy to go back to work, and I hope the corporation signed the contract.
For now, the pickets are down. On Tuesday, 4,300 hotel workers will start rotating back into their shifts without conditions while the talks continue. But until a deal is inked, the situation remains tenuous, and Local 2 members say they are prepared to resume the pickets if a fair contract isn't offered. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Vinnie Lombardo.
Today, President Bush visited Colombia to meet with his staunchest Latin American supporter in the war against terrorism, President Álvaro Uribe. Among other topics Uribe and Bush discussed were the free trade agreement currently being negotiated, the extension of Plan Colombia, and the counter-drug program that uses aerial fumigations, which is due to expire in 2005. Meanwhile, analysts say the 10-month-old counterinsurgent offensive being supported by the U.S. military against Colombia's 40-year-old rebels is doomed. From Bogota, Nicole Carson has more.
Since taking office in August 2002, hardline President Álvaro Uribe has enlisted increasing U.S. military support to help the Colombian armed forces regain territories controlled by the 18,000-strong rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the FARC. Working together with the U.S. Southern Command, the Colombian military launched the Patriot Plan in January 2004, deploying some 18,000 Colombian troops to comb through southern jungle terrain controlled by the FARC throughout the 40-year-old armed conflict. But after 10 months of intense military operations in four Colombian states, the guerrilla structures have not been weakened, nor has the Colombian government been able to capture one of their 14 secretariat leaders. With most of the armed forces concentrated in the heart of the insurgent stronghold, analysts say the FARC are undertaking a tactical retreat, not defending their territory, and leaving only snipers and landmines to await Colombian troops, causing many casualties. According to Colombian military analyst Alfredo Rangel, not only are the Colombian armed forces unsuccessful at critically weakening the FARC, neither the armed forces nor the rebels are capable of a military triumph.
The Patriot Plan and the armed forces in southern Colombia run the risk of getting sucked into a black hole by exerting tremendous effort, investing large amounts of resources, and staying there for a long time, and in the end, not achieving their goal with the rebels. Unfortunately, it seems that the FARC's strategy of retreat has been to their own advantage.
General Reynaldo Castellanos commanded the Patriot Plan until he was promoted last week to the chief commander of the Colombian Army. He says the combined operation of the Colombian armed forces has gained control of the rivers in this region, blocking important access for rebels to obtain arms and food, as well as breaking the FARC's control over the population. However, the human rights number-crunching organization CODES reports that the first 6 months of this year marked a threefold increase in the number of displaced people in the region, from 5,000 to 15,000 in the municipality of Cartagena de Chaira alone. Antonio Fajardo is the vice president of the Juntas Comunales in Cartagena del Chaira.
The Patriot Plan has caused massive displacement, and it's made it difficult for campesinos to get goods into the region, since the army has checkpoints that limit the amount of food we can bring to the villages. They also restrict the medicine, saying it's medicine for the guerrilla, but it's for the people's clinics.
On November 15th, the new Southern Command Chief, General Bance Craddock, visited Bogota and pledged the United States' continued involvement in the Patriot Plan, which so far has meant providing training for mobile units, intelligence, and logistical support of supply lines. During the past 5 years, the United States has given Colombia more than $3 billion in military aid, which before 2002 was confined exclusively to counter-drug missions like aerial fumigations. Since then, the U.S. mission has been expanded to include U.S. Special Forces training, counter-insurgency units, and the protection of oil pipelines. From the D.C.-based Center for International Policy, senior analyst Adam Isaacson.
The potential for escalation, I mean, the potential for keep going down the slippery slope is huge. And certainly the Colombians the Colombian government is happy to have us there and would love to have us playing a bigger role in fighting the guerrillas.
In October, Congress granted the Bush administration's request and doubled the limit on U.S. military personnel permitted in Colombia from 400 to 800, as well as increasing U.S. contractors from 400 to 600. The rebel-controlled jungles are difficult terrain, and since 1998, 11 U.S. contractors have been killed on duty in Colombia, and three have been held hostage by the FARC for nearly 2 years. The Bush administration will not request further U.S. aid to Colombia until early next year, but Bush's Colombian visit was seen as a positive opportunity for President Uribe to solicit more U.S. involvement in Colombia's conflict. From Bogota, this is Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.